Welcome everyone to episode 11 of the Real MVP podcast, and I'm your host, Modern Vintage Gamer. Now, we have a guest on the show tonight. Stephen Kick is the CEO of Night Dive Studios, and as someone personally who grew up in the 90s, playing games like Turok, Sin, Power Slave, Strife, and many other PC games, for me, they're easily one of my favorite development houses going around right now, and Night Dive has been bringing these games back to a new generation of player and console, and they just recently released Doom 64, which I absolutely love, especially the Nintendo 64 version, which was kind of underrated, and a lot of people kind of forgot about it. But Stephen, thanks for your time this evening, and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's definitely a very tumultuous time, and it's nice to be able to put out some really fun releases that is resonating with so many people.
Absolutely. It's definitely an escape from the world right now. And I guess, you know, my first question is, you know, how are you doing? And, you know, this coronavirus stuff is absolutely crazy, and it's affecting every single one of us in one way or the other, whether you know someone who's been impacted by it, or you know, you just have anxiety, or you've got family. I mean, everyone is, you know, kind of a little anxious right now. You know, how are you doing, and how are you coping with things kind of day to day?
Well, you know, it's kind of all of the above. I mean, I know people personally that have been afflicted with it. My mom is thankfully very healthy, but we decided to kind of self-isolate. So she's at her house. We've been here for 14 days, so we haven't really got to see family in quite a while. But besides that, you know, in terms of Night Dive, it's business as usual because we are all remote. Yep. So for the last 7 years, we've all just been kind of working from our home offices. So you could say that we were probably prepared for something like this. Not that, you know, we ever discussed the eventuality of a worldwide pandemic, but it is kind of nice to be in a position where we can keep doing what we're doing and making sure that, like you said, some of our fans and some of our followers have kind of a continuous source of games to kind of escape and have some fun and kind of just forget about what's happening for at least a little while.
Definitely. Yeah. And, you know, the remote thing, I mean, like you said, it's not something that you probably prepared for, you know, a pandemic, a worldwide pandemic, but having the virtual kind of office set up is one that is quite great to have, especially in this time with, you know, with everything that's happening. How is the virtual office working for you guys? I mean, I know I've worked in a remote environment before, and some of the things that I do right now, you know, are kind of remote. There's always a level of, you know, there's always that you're always kind of putting your faith in the technology, making sure that, you know, your VPNs are all up and running and everything is working the way you expect it to. How has that virtual office or that remote environment been working for you guys over the years?
It's been pretty steady. We've had our occasional outages, like on Discord. You know, if they have a server issue one day, no one will be able to talk to each other, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And then, you know, occasionally our SVN goes down, but it's never long enough, or it never lasts to a, you know, a point where it's become disruptive.
Right.
I'd say, you know, probably one of the biggest drawbacks for me personally is I'm a very social person, and I really like to, you know, meet people face to face. And some of the people that have been working for me, you know, for 6+ years, like, I've never met in person, which is very strange. There's also, you know, you lose that kind of sense of camaraderie. You know, we can't take lunch breaks together and play deathmatch or something like that and be in the same room and have that kind of energy that you get with a lot of, you know, just indie game studios, that type of thing. But, you know, everybody is very self-sufficient. And I'd say one of the biggest advantages is that we have been able to draw from the talent pool of the world as a result of this, instead of having to rely on people in our, you know, general area, or having to relocate people to us. So, yeah. You know, when we bring someone on, it's like, you know, day one, hey, welcome to the team. And there's no like wind up of them moving and all these other things that kind of come into play. So, yeah, there's some advantages, some disadvantages. Right now, I feel like, you know, we're kind of at an advantage. We can keep kind of pumping stuff out, and we haven't really slowed down.
That's fantastic. I mean, where some of the larger companies, and I'm not picking on anyone certainly, but some of the large companies may have stumbled a little bit because they don't necessarily have the appropriate infrastructure set up. You guys are just kind of, you know, going on as normal, which is great. And I think, you know, I think if anything comes out of this, I mean, there's definitely going to be a lot that comes out of this, but I think business is going to be done in different ways, you know, when this is all said and done. I think there's going to be a lot more of a focus on the virtual office or the remote person. You know, I've got a family here, and my wife actually, she's been telling me stories about how, you know, she's worked in an office for 20 years, and all of a sudden now they're thinking about making it more optional, where you can basically work wherever you want because they have the everything set up now to do so. So, I mean, I think there's definitely going to see some changes in the world after, you know, after this virus is all said and done. And I think, you know, in some cases, for the better, I think it will definitely help.
Some people definitely strive in a remote, you know, working from home kind of environment, but there are, you know, certain people that prefer being surrounded by their peers and their colleagues. And so again, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages. You know, one of the most important things for me now, I have a 11-month-old son, and you know, as long as I get the work done, as long as everybody else gets the work done, like, you know, take the afternoon off, you know, spend those hours with your kids, with your family, and then, you know, work whenever it's convenient for you. And if corporations are kind of adopting these practices, I think that, you know, the general happiness level of everyone is gonna go up as a result of that.
Definitely. Well, hey, congrats on the success of Doom 64. One for the fans of Doom absolutely love, and you know, the modern update really makes the game so much more accessible to everyone. Like mm-hmm. I said, it was a game that it was a little overlooked on the N64 because everyone was playing, you know, Banjo-Kazooie and Mario Kart and all the heavy hitters at the time. Doom 64 didn't really fit very, very well. And back in those days, it didn't review particularly great, but it's one of those games that's just an absolute classic. How do you think the new update you guys brought out turned out? You happy with the way it turned out?
I honestly couldn't be happier. I keep trying to, again, you know, this goes back to the remote office thing. Like, I would have loved to have held a party for these guys because they poured their heart and their soul into this. I mean, just getting to work on anything related to the Doom franchise is a huge milestone for everybody involved, for Night Dive. And I would have loved to have been able to celebrate in any way, you know, with these people in a physical location. So yeah, we're very, very pleased with how it came out, and very, just excited to see the constant flow of positive reviews across all platforms, which is another big milestone for us. We've never done a simultaneous launch across PC, Xbox, Switch, and PlayStation, which is, you know, kind of the norm for a larger studio, but, this was our first one, and it really couldn't have gone smoother.
Yeah. I mean, I can only imagine the certification process to kind of get all four of those, you know, ready to launch. It would have been interesting for you guys, you know, with kind of the smaller team, but it sounds like you guys were all over it and got it done, no sweat. So, and like you said, I mean, for me, it turned out exceptionally well, especially with the, you know, the modern enhancements that you brought to the game, and it's something that you've kind of been known to do with other releases as well. My question is, what made you decide to form a video game company all those years ago? What was kind of the fire that you had inside of you that made you decide, I want to give this a go and see where I can end up doing this?
It's a really good question. Well, you know, it pretty much started back in the 90s when my family got its first computer. It was a Hewlett Packard 100 megahertz computer with 16 megs of RAM, 1 gigabyte hard drive. You know, at the time, top of the line, I think, you know, we spent probably like $5,000 on it. It was just, you know, one of those things. And I distinctly remember going out of the store and putting a copy of the shareware version of Doom in the cart. And we get to the checkout and they're ringing things up and I'm hoping nobody notices that it's there. And of course, my mom, her eyes immediately go to it and she looks at it and she's like, Doom. She's like, no, we're not, we're not buying this. And as a, you know, compromise, they got me Dark Forces, which was a very,
it's a pretty good compromise.
It was considered to be kind of a Doom clone at the time, but really it had a number of advancements that went well beyond Doom. And so I grew up, you know, from there I went to Jedi Knight Dark Forces 2, all the LucasArts classics. That was pretty much my pedigree growing up. And I subscribed to PC Gamer, you know, from almost the first issue. And by the time I had reached the age of 18, I really didn't have any idea what I wanted to do for school. And I remember, you know, getting a copy of PC Gamer and opening up to a page that had an advertisement for an art school in San Francisco that was offering a game art and design degree, like a bachelor's degree attached to that. And I showed it to my mom and I was like, this is what I want to do. I want to make video games. And so she pretty much just flew me out there sight unseen. And I did a tour of the campus and I just instantly fell in love with the curriculum and the teachers and, you know, the students who, actually some of them I've employed, some of my classmates. I just excelled in that program. And when I graduated, I got an internship at like a mobile game company. I was actually working, with, this company called Digital Chocolate, which was run by Trip Hawkins, mm-hmm. which was the founder of Electronic Arts. So that was really cool. And then I ended up moving to San Diego and I got a job at an indie game company that was building a single player campaign game with the Crytek engine. And it was one of the first companies to do that. I ended up getting a job at Sony Online Entertainment not too long after. I was actually trying to get a job there because my girlfriend at the time was working there as a character artist.
On the EverQuest franchise at all, or one of the other games?
Not EverQuest. It was actually a MMO for kids called Free Realms.
I remember that one, yeah. I'm very familiar with Sony Online. I was a big EverQuest player and back in the day, and I've been to a couple of those fan fairs they used to have down in Las Vegas. If you were around for those,
yeah, that was really fun. That was a great time to be with the company. The sights were set very, very high for Free Realms, and it had this kind of whimsical, cartoony, hand painted art style, which was really fun and something that I specialized in at the time. So I was a really good fit for that. I ended up getting moved to the Clone Wars Adventures team, which was a Star Wars game that was kind of like, it was almost like a 3D version of Club Penguin, but for like Star Wars, like Clone Wars, all based off the running show.
Yeah,
that was on at the time. And that was really fun. That was almost coming full circle with some of the Dark Forces stuff, because at one point we get to choose what we wanted to make for wearables for the characters. And I got to pick, Kyle Katarn, Mara Jade, who was in the Mysteries of Sith expansion pack for Dark Forces 2. I got to do the AT-AT or the AT-AT walker. I got to make tons of stuff from Star Wars, and that was just, super fun. Then after that, we were ramping up for Planetside 2, and I got put on that project. And as you can imagine, it was a pretty like amazing departure, or a huge departure from the hand painted art style. I was, you know, doing high poly stuff in ZBrush, and making normal maps and spec maps and all this other stuff. And it really pushed me pretty hard.
And they were, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they were dropping PlanetSide 2 to the PlayStation 4, or it did come out for the PS4. My timeline's a little fuzzy, but I do remember they were working on a PS4 version of that game. Were you involved with that at all?
No, I want to say that when I was there, I think they were trying to get it on the PS3.
Right.
And honestly, I don't think that happened, but I'm not 100% sure.
I remember the last fanfare I went to, they were showing off PlanetSide 2 on a PS3. I remember they had a couple of test kits and they were showing them off at the show. And I guess after that, things were a little fuzzy for me because, you know, as you know, Sony Online Entertainment, they basically collapsed and they got bought out by Daybreak, I think it was, that ended up buying them and kind of running that company. But I think they had the PS4 version ready to go. I'm not really sure what happened to it in the end, but that's awesome that you got a chance to work on that game. I know that was very, very popular at the time. There were thousands of people playing that game and some real hardcore fans of that game as well.
Yeah, it felt good to kind of graduate from working on kids games to something that was more, mature. And, I had been kind of honing my skills on the art side, the character art side for years, prior and during my tenure there. So I was pretty much, one of maybe half a dozen people at the studio who had the experience necessary to kind of just jump in and start making, high quality content. And, on a personal side, I felt like my career was really starting to kind of take off in terms of, almost reaching the higher echelons of being a character artist and kind of being able to write my own ticket to any studio I wanted to go to if that was my desire. And for the longest time, that was kind of my dream, was to get to a stage where I could go, I want to work at id, mm-hmm. or I want to work at Respawn or whatever, if there was a project that I was particularly interested in. But that isn't the way it went. What it ended up happening was my girlfriend quit her job at Sony on Clone Wars about a year before that. And she had just kind of gotten burned out and she started her own business, actually making video game plushies. Mm-hmm. So plush characters based on video game characters. And she had expressed to me that she wanted to go on a trip, like a worldwide trip kind of thing, or a trip down through Central America to South America and essentially, kind of just get off the grid and just explore while we were still in our early 20s. And like I was saying at the time, I felt like I was really starting to excel at my job and I was kind of moving up the ladder a little bit and I wasn't ready. But I'd say after about a year of development on PlanetSide 2, I had reached a point where I was like, I could probably use a break because I'm starting to get a little burned out.
Yeah.
So we basically saved up all the money that we had. I quit my job and we loaded everything up that was essential into this little 4-door Honda Civic. And we just drove across the border in Tijuana.
how crazy does that sound right now?
I know. I'm like, I'm just thinking about it, like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. It was a while ago. but we got to Ensenada and we spent the night there. And then over the next 10 months, we traveled, down the Baja Peninsula. We took a ferry over to Tablabampo. We did the entire Copper Canyons. We went all the way through Mexico, through Oaxaca, through the Yucatan Peninsula. We went to probably a dozen Mayan ruins. We did some diving in cenotes. We went to Belize and we dove the Blue Hole. we went south and we went to Guatemala, Nicaragua, El Salvador, every country in Central America. And then finally we got to the Panama Canal, which is basically like, you can't really go any further unless, you know, you've got like a caravan that's protected by, you know, armed guards kind of thing.
Yeah.
And before we got to that point, this is kind of where Night Dive ended up. We were in Guatemala and we were staying in a hostel called El Retiro. And it was in this very remote part of the jungle where we had to drive very, very carefully to get out, like down into this valley. And there was a point when we were going down into it, I was like, we may not ever get this car out of here. Like, this could be, you know, its final resting place. Like, I'm not sure this little four cylinder manual Civic has what it takes to get out of here when we want to leave.
Yeah.
We stayed there for a couple weeks. They had satellite internet, which was kind of cool. But it's just a beautiful place. And there was this wild thunderstorm one night, just like lightning cracking overhead and the trees are swaying. And, you know, we've got candles lit in our little, in our bunk. And I was like, you know what? This is like the perfect time to play System Shock 2. And, so I brought this little netbook, this, you know, very underwhelming little thing. And I had loaded it up with a bunch of classic games like Grim Fandango, Full Throttle, Fallout 2 was on there, and System Shock 2. And I just assumed that it was just going to run. You know, I was going to double click the installer, it would install, and I'd be good to go. I'd be, you know, on the Von Braun in a matter of minutes. And I couldn't get it to run, couldn't get it to install. I tried everything that I kind of, you know, knew how to do, you know, set the compatibility modes, yada, yada. Wouldn't work. So I went to GOG.com because I figured they have to have it. It's one of the greatest games of all time. It's, you know, I'm going to put $10 down and I'm going to be playing this. Well, it wasn't there either, but it did turn up on their wish list, which was at the time their number one most wished for game. So it kind of sparked this idea that I should just go on this detective hunt and try to track down the rights to this game. Like, what happened? Like, there's got to be a story, a reason why this thing isn't available. So I just, you know, from that moment on, I just started digging. And I ended up finding this article written by Jared Newman for G4 TV.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking about this earlier today, and I found the link and I was like, how did I even find this? I ended up using the Wayback Machine to get a cached version of that because G4 TV was owned by the Sci-Fi Channel. And if you try going to that site now, it just auto directs you to sci-fi.com.
Yeah.
And anyways, there was a little tidbit of information in that article about how when Looking Glass went out of business, their assets got split. So the rights and the copyright in the game went to this insurance company called Meadowbrook, and the trademark went to Electronic Arts. And I basically just found some contact information on the Meadowbrook website, and I sent them a thing that said, hey, you guys have the rights to System Shock. What are you doing with it? And I wasn't really expecting anything, you know, back. But the next day I got an email from, you know, their attorney, and he's like, yeah, we got the rights. What do you want to do with it? Do you want to make System Shock 3? And, you know, like I said, I'm in the middle of the jungle, satellite internet. And, you know, I've got $5,000 to my name, maybe.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh geez, like, what did I just get myself into? And I was like, well, obviously I can't do that, but I've got, you know, a lot of friends that are programmers from the industry. I'm sure it wouldn't be hard to convince one of them to help me get this thing up and running and, you know, release it. So I pitched that to them. And I said, well, why don't we release the first two games in the franchise digitally on know, Steam, GOG, whatever. And they wrote back, said, well, no one's ever pitched that to us before, but you know what? We really like that. You know, we don't have to oversee any game development and the stuff's already here. So, yeah, you want to write a contract up and we'll, you know, we'll look it over. And again, I'm, you know, still in Guatemala.
Yeah.
And so at that point, you know, we decided to leave. We did the rest of our traveling and I kind of kept a correspondence with them. And when we got back and we crossed the border, we were staying at some family's house in New Mexico. And I just continued the conversation there. And I had a phone call with them. It went really great. They kind of laid out their deal terms and everything. And they wanted a sum of money that I was like, I don't know how I'm going to get that.
Yep.
But I'll find a way. And the weird thing is, this is totally bizarre. And it makes me believe that there's some force in the universe that's there for us every once in a while. I got off the phone and go on Kotaku.com just to kind of depressurize. And the leading article is about how some anonymous modder had just released an unofficial patch for System Shock 2 that made it completely playable.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I downloaded the patch right on that same laptop, dragged it into the directory with the System Shock 2 assets, and bam, it just started working like perfectly right out of the box. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. This is unbelievable. So the story gets a little weird from there, from that perspective, because I tried to reach out to this person, but they have wanted to remain anonymous.
Right.
And I've tried many, many times. But what eventually happened was I asked my friends and family for money and, I had enough people kind of believe in me or just be ready to lose the money, you know, just in case. Sent the money to the insurance company. They granted me the rights to, redistribute the game. I wrote to GOG.com and said, hey, I've got the rights. And they wrote back and said, yeah, you're full of shit.
They didn't believe you, huh?
No, they did not believe me. So I had to send them, you know, the redacted version of the contract.
Yep.
And then they launched it and it just did amazingly well. And from that moment on, I basically was like, well, what other games are out there? What else can I bring back so that people can enjoy them again?
Man, that is an incredible story, dude. I mean, I know you've probably told that a few times, you know, over the years, but that's the most fascinating story about someone getting or starting their own game development company I've ever heard. That's absolutely incredible, dude. You know, I think for me, you know, the biggest takeaway is you saw that opportunity and you jumped all over it, and that is something that a lot of people may not have kind of followed through with, but you really kind of just took it all the way. When did you kind of decide that, hey, maybe it's time to start the LLC and get this company, you know, official and everything? Was it during that time or was it kind of after you got the rights?
It was pretty much the day of, because they ended up supplying their own paper, their own contract to us. And, you know, there was a blank spot on the contract for you to put your company name.
Yeah.
Not you know,
your personal name or your.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like on most contracts, there's like it's almost like a template. It says, you know, licensor, quotations, Night Dive Studios, Inc., a corporation registered in the state of blank. And I remember seeing that and being like, oh man, I need to start a company like right now. So yeah. I went on to LegalZoom, I think, at the time, or the corporation company, and we took a quick walk around the neighborhood and we tried to brainstorm ideas to what to name the company, because we're like, man, this is, you know, we're going to be stuck with this name. It should be something cool. And so Nighttime is what we came up with. And so it all kind of happened in tandem.
So, I mean, you guys were very well known for picking up the licenses, you know, to the older games, the older DOS and console games. And obviously, your story really puts into perspective some of the other releases you brought to a modern era. But a lot of these games are a little obscure, and I guess no one else really seemed that interested in bringing them back. You guys were more than happy to do so. What's the thought process into going into looking in a back catalog and saying, you know, I'd really like to bring Power Slave back, or I'd really like to bring Sin back, or, you know, these games that were very, very popular, but, you know, they weren't necessarily that successful at the time, but you guys seem to have no issue bringing them back. What's the thought process there about, you know, the decision making on bringing some of these games back?
It's definitely changed over the years. When we first started, it was more, what games do I remember fondly playing, you know, with my dad or with my friends that you can't get anymore? And that's where you get stuff like Bad Mojo, the Roach game.
Mm-hmm.
It's where you get like Harvester, Time Lapse, the Humongous games. What else? Noctropolis. You know, some of these like kind of weirder, more obscure, like you said, experimental adventure games mostly. And that was just really fun for me.
Yeah.
For a lot of different reasons, primarily being I got to talk to the original developers because most of the rights for those games belong to them and not like a big publisher, because, you know, even big publishers didn't really touch games like that back then. So I got to talk to them, and we did some fun interviews with some of the creators, and they were just really thrilled that anybody would be still interested in playing those games. And when we released them, we found that there's a small but very dedicated community around each and every one of them. And while at our current scale and kind of growth of, you know, the company, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to do some of those smaller games. There's still a bunch that I'm kind of working on the side to re-release in one way or another. But to answer your question now, like when we go and we look for stuff, we look for games that would make really good candidates to port to our internal engine, mm-hmm. the Kex engine, which has allowed us the possibility to port to multiple platforms. So that's why Turok 1 and 2 is on Xbox and Nintendo Switch. It's why Forsaken's on Xbox. It's why, like I said, we could do Doom 64 across all four of them.
Strife is another great game that I really like. It's very underrated. It's an id Tech 1 game that has RPG elements. I'm actually quite familiar with the game's source code. I ended up porting it to the Commodore Amiga back in 2013, so I'm very familiar with the game. You guys released it in 2014. I have a question, and you may not know the answer to this, but you may know the answer to this. From what I understand, Strife was... the source code was lost for that game, so mm-hmm. I ended up using like the Chocolate Doom source code to port it. Did you guys actually get a hold of the original source for the game, or was there another way that you ended up bringing that game forward?
We did not get the original source code. I think the answer you're looking for is on the... might be on the Doom Wiki.
Oh, right, yeah.
I don't exactly remember what the guys used for that.
I believe they reversed it, basically, because, I mean, it's an id Tech 1 game, so it uses the Doom engine, but it had mm-hmm. kind of modifications, so I can only assume that they ripped apart the, you know, the WAD file and kind of work backwards from there, which probably wouldn't have been that difficult to do, but there definitely would have been work involved. And I guess my curiosity was, you know, were you guys able to recover the original source for the game?
No, unfortunately. And that's kind of the story for the majority of games that we, you know, get a hold of, is the source has been long forgotten or lost somewhere on some DAT tape, you know?
Yeah. Is there a game that you wanna, or you've been in negotiations to bring or to license, but because there's just no source available, it's one of those things where it's a bit of a dead end where you just can't really proceed with the deal?
Oh yeah, there's one in particular, and this goes back to weird and obscure. This is probably one of the weirdest and obscure games I've ever played. But have you ever heard of The Resident's Bad Day in the Midway?
I have heard of the game, but I have never played it before. But I have heard of it, yeah.
Super bizarre. And I think that you could probably get it running maybe with Windows 3.1 running inside of DOSBox.
Right.
I think. But what happened there was I was a really big fan of the really bizarre Inkscape title. So Bad Day in the Midway was one. The Dark Eye was one. It was a point-and-click adventure game that was set in a Edgar Allan Poe story, mm-hmm. but it was like the models were like all claymation, very unsettling art style. And the other one was called Drowned God, which, I could talk about that game for hours. It's so bizarre. But so I ended up reaching out to the programmer of Bad Day in the Midway because we had kind of reached an agreement with the rights holders to re-release the game. And unfortunately, it was built on, I think, Director. So,
yeah,
you know, if you want to talk antiquated, you know, game engines or, you know, Director poses its own unique set of challenges. But this is the real heartbreaker is I got in touch with the programmer. And he's like, you wouldn't believe this, but I tossed all the boxes of tapes and assets and everything for that game like a week ago.
Oh, wow.
And I just was like,
oh, man.
Oh, my heart felt like it was just splitting in half because it's such a weird game that like it would almost find its own scene today, I think, if it were to be re-released because right. It's just so bizarre.
Absolutely. And I mean, just from a preservation standpoint, you know, losing that source code, you know, potentially forever is heartbreaking as well.
Yeah, I mean, it may never be played again. Who knows? Yeah,
that's when you say it that way, it's a shame. But man, I always just cry a little on the inside when I hear those stories. You know, hopefully not too many more of those will happen going forward. I think a lot of people really understand the value of preserving things a lot more now than they used to. But hopefully we can recover some of this old stuff and bring it forward.
You know, for every story there is like that, we've got another that's, you know, on the opposite side of that spectrum. So when we started working on Turok 1, we had originally reverse engineered the code up to a certain point. And when it got announced, the lead producer, Stephen Bromley, I think his name was, mm-hmm. he actually emailed me and said, hey, I've got the source code. Do you want it? And I was like, yeah. So he sent it and I sent it to the guys and they were like, where did you get this? And then he says, oh, I got the code for Turok 2 as well. You want that? It's like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. So I still owe him some physical copies of the game that we did with Limited Run. And I haven't gotten any in hand yet. So that's like one of my top priorities.
Right on. I got to ask, one of my favorite games is No One Lives Forever. I know there were some rumors that you guys were considering re-releasing it a couple of years ago, or more than a couple of years ago now. And I'm assuming there were licensing issues that went down there. I think there was a few different players that were involved. Can you talk about what went down there in any detail at all?
Yeah, to some degree. Basically, our discussions landed us between three corporations. So 20th Century Fox, who kind of absorbed Fox Interactive after it had been partially sold to Vivendi, which then had merged with Activision, then split again. and then there you've got Monolith, the developer,
yeah,
who was then acquired by Warner Brothers.
Man, everything so, you just said is giving me a headache. You know what I mean?
I know. Well, my like, oh my God, like just saying that, it feels like my head's splitting apart and like all these brands are just snapping, you know, like. So, yeah, nobody has really any idea who owns what.
Yeah.
Because of all that. I think I've narrowed it down to two. One of those potentially being 20th Century Fox, which was just acquired by Disney. So you want to introduce another player in the game? That's one.
And a big one.
And a big one. Probably the biggest one.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah, I mean, that's kind of where everything is laying right now. I mean, I've still got, you know, open threads with certain people about this and that. And actually today, it's funny. I mean, it's not funny you bring it up. I kind of knew you were going to bring it up.
Yeah.
But I've got like a saved search thing on eBay for No One Lives Forever, just in case anything weird shows up, because you never know.
Yep.
And over the years, I've bought the regular big box edition, the Game of the Year edition, the PlayStation 2 port of the first game, and then the big box of the second game and the small box of the second game. I've also managed to pick up this really bizarre, I want to say it was probably like a press giveaway or some kind of incentive for reviewing the game, but it's a martini glass set with a shaker mm-hmm. that has No One Lives Forever like laser etched on the side. My plan was I was going to get that. And then, you know, when we would eventually announce the acquisition or that we were working on it, I was going to like, you know, drink a martini out of it or whatever. But today something showed up on my searches that I'd never seen before. And it's not really exciting. It's like a day planner
mm-hmm.
With a calendar in it for the year 2000, which is when the game came out.
Right.
But it's got the logo on it. And it says, you know, 20th Century Fox on the bottom. So I bought that.
That's cool as hell, man. I love that stuff.
Yeah, it's just weird. Like, I've seen T-shirts show up. There was another weird little thing that came out for No One Lives Forever 2. It's like it's hard to explain. It's like something that you put in your ear, and then I think it just amplifies the volume around you. So it's supposed to be like a little spy listening.
Right. Like a listening device or something.
Yeah. But it's branded. It says No One Lives Forever 2 on it. Yeah. It's just fun stuff like that.
Nice, man. Well, hopefully, you know, those open, discussions will lead somewhere eventually. I mean, I think it's one of those things that a lot of people would be really excited to see. Is it going to happen? I mean, we're not really sure, but I mean, it's great that you're still kind of actively pursuing it, and you know, maybe one day we'll get to the bottom of the web of different companies, and you know, we'll get some traction on getting the game back where it belongs, out to be released to the public.
Yeah, that would be. I mean, on that day, I'll be ready with a martini.
I'll be watching Twitter for the post. I'm sure. One of the games that I swore that we would never see get remade was Blade Runner, and you guys announced the Enhanced Edition recently. Man, I couldn't even tell you how psyched I was when you guys announced that. How was your kind of thought process when you kind of inked the deal there? I mean, obviously, you're someone that, you know, grew up playing PC games on your old PCs back in the day. And, you know, for me, this is one of those games that really has a lot of meaning, because I mean, I love the hell out of that game. And when you guys announced that recently, I was just, I almost started crying. It was that emotional for me that you kind of brought it forward. So what was kind of your thought, emotions and feelings when, you know, you signed the contract on that one?
It was a surreal moment, because when I, you know, when I was telling you earlier that after System Shock 2, you know, kind of opened the door to this business, Blade Runner was pretty much the next game I just made a beeline for, pretty much right out of the gate. So that was like, you know, in November, it would be like 8 years. So like, I've been looking for that game. I've been trying to do something with it for like over 7. And I have poured so much of myself into just trying to make it happen any way I could, that the, you know, the day that I finally signed that, it was like, you know, is this real life? Like this, I can't believe this is happening. And, you know, my love for the game started, you know, way back, you know, probably the first time I saw the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I just instantly fell in love with the universe and the characters and the whole genre, I think, as a result of that. And, you know, I've read some of the books and, of course, played the game and was a big Westwood fanboy growing up. I loved Command & Conquer. That's pretty much our go-to game, like all, you know, me and my friends growing up.
Yeah.
And, yeah, this story is kind of fun because the rights changed hands, or right when we were kind of getting close is when Alcon Entertainment had more or less started producing 2049. And, you know, I'm not sure if it, you know, the movies mean as much to you as they do to me, but, you know, finding that out, that there was going to be a new Blade Runner, was almost like, how do I put it? It was like, if I don't get the game, at least we get this new movie.
Dude, that movie was freaking incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I haven't gone to the movie theaters in a really long time. And the last time I saw any movie like more than once in the theater was, I mean, maybe like Sin City.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was fantastic, but you know, I went and I saw Blade Runner 2049 like 3 times in the theater.
It was ridiculous how good that movie was, man. Like when that came out, I remember reading the reviews and people were saying, this is a really good sequel. And you know, me being the old skeptic, I was like, yeah, I'm sure it is, but it's nothing like the original. But I was blown away when I saw that movie, dude. I thought it was exceptional.
Yeah, to put it in perspective, when it came out on 4K, I basically, I somehow convinced my wife to like let me upgrade our entire home theater to 4K.
just for Blade Runner?
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
But yeah, one of the cool little stories about it is a number of years ago, I was trying to get in touch with the Blade Runner Partnership, which was the group of producers who were responsible for basically making the first movie. And they were the group of people that also, you know, did the licensing for the Westwood game. And I had spoke to Lewis Castle, who was the founder of Westwood, and he kind of pointed me in the right direction. It had been so many years since then that, you know, he didn't have any contacts or resources really to look into. But one day I was just kind of doing a cursory glance, you know, for some of the Blade Runner Partnership members, one of them being Bud Yorkin. And this listing came up on a realtor website because his house was for sale. And I called the realtor and I said, hey, I'm not interested in Bud Yorkin's property, but I do want to license something from him. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to do an introduction. And I kind of gave him the pitch about what we did and what I was looking to do. And the realtor's like, oh man, I love some of the games you've worked on. Yeah, sure. Let me, you know, I'll get right back to you. So about a week later, his wife, Cynthia, called me back, who was more or less kind of handling the business side of the Blade Runner Partnership. And she's, you know, such a wonderful person. And she was very enthusiastic about what we were doing. And we kind of got bounced around to some of her assistants. And it was pretty much right at that time where 2049 was like right going into production. And so any chance of doing anything with the classic game was pretty much put on hold for, you know, 3-4 years now, I think it's been since the movie came out. But the rights changed hands to Alcon Entertainment, and we met with them at GDC a couple times, and you know, I think that the stars kind of aligned and they were ready to do something with it, and you know, we were right there in the wings. So that's kind of how that all happened.
Outstanding, man. That's great news. And you seem like, you know, you don't stop, you know, you just overturn every single rock until you find what you're looking for. And I love that about, you know, what you guys do, and hopefully that will continue. What is the Holy Grail for you? Is there something out there that you really want to get that is just kind of unattainable, but it doesn't matter. You still want to get your hands on? What's the Holy Grail for you?
Oh, well, it's known this forever. But if I had to pick another one, oh man, I have like, this is the painful part of my job, is that, you know, every day I think about all these old games that I used to play, and like, which is the one that I would, you know, I should take a stab at, or I should think about, or what game would be so cool if it came back. And this may not be like a holy grail, but it would be so cool to make a new Primal Rage.
Oh, dude. Hell yeah.
Like, I really love fighting games, but Primal, you know, I played them all back then, but Primal Rage was just my absolute favorite.
That's a great game.
It wasn't a great game. Like super balanced, or, you know, it wasn't the, like, you know, like I said, it wasn't the best fighting game, but the claymation style and the different dinosaurs and just the whole plot was really cool. Like, essentially the world ends and all the continents like merge again.
Yeah.
Like they used to be, and these giant, you know, lizard gods have emerged from the earth, and they each have their own little cult of followers. And basically you have to destroy the other gods and become, you know, Lord of the Earth. Like, that's just, it's just so cool.
That sounds cool, man. Did you ever play the sequel, the arcade sequel that was kind of leaked, or not leaked, it was dumped, the ROMs were found, and the PCB was found, and they dumped the ROMs and everything. Have you tried that one yet?
I didn't try that one, but I've followed that story. It's always really fun to see, you know, canceled games or games that were never released kind of see the light of day in some way or another. Just one more quick thing about Primal Rage. Like, I think one of the coolest mechanics was that you could like kick one of your followers up in the air and eat them and get some of your health back.
Yeah, great. I mean, the arcades back in the 90s were some of the best arcade games ever made. I mean, for me, you know, I always think that a lot of people ask, you know, what is the best era in video games? And it's a toss-up between, for me, the sixth generation, the original Xbox, the PS2, and the GameCube era, the Dreamcast era. But I'm very, very fond of the, you know, late 90s era, because you had amazing arcade games coming out. You had like Ninja Turtles, and you had the Street Fighter games, you had Mortal Kombat and Primal Rage. You had like these brilliant arcade games. And then you had, you know, PC gaming, you know, you had your Dooms, you had Turok, you had all that stuff as well. And you had the consoles. I mean, it was like this amazing time where it didn't really matter what system you owned, unless it was like a, you know, like a Jaguar or something. I mean, you were playing some good games, you know, pretty much everywhere. And there was, the creativity was just off the chain at the time, I felt like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, you know, I think that there was a pretty big lull from, I would say, maybe like mid-2000s to maybe probably the beginning of like the indie kind of renaissance, where there just wasn't a whole lot, because there were no, you know, there weren't as many indies. So there weren't as many people like willing to take risks on like kind of like really bizarre games.
Yeah.
And I feel like that era of time was kind of just more or less punctuated by like military shooters, and things turning gray and brown and not being very colorful. And I remember becoming pretty jaded around that time period.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, obviously now it's a different story. And then back then it's, you know, you had a lot of different developers doing a lot of different things. And I kind of refer to that era as like the Wild West of game development.
How do you feel about video games in 2020? You know, we've got a lot of remasters, remakes, games being brought forward. You know, you guys are obviously involved in that. You have, you know, a piece of that. But there's a lot of games that are being brought back for the Switch on the eShop. There's a lot of older, you know, NES, Super NES titles that are coming back. And there's also obviously the AAA games that are still being churned out at the moment. We've got new consoles coming up later this year, hopefully at least, unless they don't get pushed due to the coronavirus, but let's assume they are. How do you feel about you know, where video games are right now? Are you happy with the way things are, or do you prefer things a different way?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a better time really to be in the games, and just there's literally something for everybody. You know, we were talking briefly about Doom Eternal, and it's one of the few games that I'll make the time to play because I just, you know, I, like I said, I got like an 11-month-old, and with everything that's going on right now, there's just not a lot of free time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the indie scene is just continues to blossom, and VR seems to be taking kind of its first steps out of like that almost like that infancy stage where it's becoming a realistic kind of contender for, you know, people's wallets. I mean, we just got a new Half-Life game. Like, that's, somebody had told me that even a year ago. I've been like, psh.
That's freaking incredible that we got a new Half-Life game, and it's excellent as well. I mean, I've got a PSVR, but I don't have an Oculus or anything, but it's making me want to get one because I need to experience that game, I think.
I used to have a Vive set up in my office, but again, because we had a baby, my wife had to move into my office, so we don't have the room anymore. I had to take it down, and I actually just gave it to my next door neighbor who's got, you know, a 12-year-old kid, and he uses it every day. So I don't know if his dad's thankful for that. Or...
Outside of running a video game studio, what do you do for fun and relaxation when you want to just unwind and de-stress after, you know, a busy day at work?
I've kind of recently rediscovered my love for guitar.
Right on. What do you play?
Mostly metal.
Mm-hmm.
I've been trying to learn the new songs from Tool off of Fear Inoculum.
Yeah.
So those have been pretty challenging because it's been a long time since I've played. I've just, you know, had to put my music stuff aside for quite a while. And, you know, those first couple of days of playing again and feeling your fingers, you know, on fire is...
Oh, dude, yeah.
Yeah, it's never pleasant, but it's kind of a good pain now, you know?
I've been playing for about 30 years. I don't really, like you, I barely play anymore. Like, I'll maybe pick it up once a week, you know, play for an hour or something. Mm-hmm. But, like, yeah, I mean, if you haven't picked it up for a while, you're going to just shred your fingers, as you know. There's a bit of pain involved, especially if you're playing six string, you know, metal as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like there's a lot of finger slides, which at first were like, you know, you're like cringing when that part's coming up in the song. You're like, oh, this is gonna hurt. but yeah, I've been having a lot of fun with that. I actually just picked up a Diesel VH4 distortion pedal.
Oh, right on.
And I am not going to be able to really use it because the only time I play is when the baby is sleeping. So
yeah, man, like I'm in the same boat as you. I don't have a little baby, but I mean, I live in a fairly conservative, you know, housing neighborhood where a lot of families live around where I do. And like, I can't just, I've got a Marshall JCM 800, 100 mm-hmm. watt amp. And dude, I can't turn that past like 3, you know what I'm saying? The volume. So it's almost, for me, it's almost easier just to put headphones on and then just play through a, you know, an effects pedal or something and plug headphones in, because I'm never going to be able to crank that thing up anywhere near a decent volume where the tubes start to really start to sizzle and it sounds really good, you know?
Yeah, that's the hard part. Like, I want to feel those sound waves, like, rattle my organs, you know? besides that, I have been doing some artwork here and there, because, you know, that was originally kind of what got me into the industry. I was a character artist. So I used some of the tools that I use for character art to do some illustrations that I was kind of inspired to do from the new album coming out, the Fear Inoculum.
Mm-hmm.
What I had done was I re-listened to all their studio albums kind of in a chronological order. So Opiate, Undertow, Anima, Lateralis, 10,000 Days, and then Fear Inoculum when it came out. And I did an illustration for each album based on, you know, the lyrics, the music videos, the album art, my own interpretations, that type of thing. And I made this giant poster. It's like 24 inches tall and 70 inches long. And I posted it on the Toolband subreddit.
Mm-hmm.
And it became like one of the top posts of all time.
Oh, dude, that's wild.
And it was so crazy. Like, I got so many messages from, you know, Tool fans like all over the world that were like, oh my God, like, you were able to, you know, interpret this album in a way that, you know, really resonated with me. And so that was a fun little thing that happened just recently.
Awesome, man. But I really want to say thank you so much for hanging out with me for the last hour and shooting the shit. I really appreciate it. Any words you want to say to the fans and maybe let them know where they can get a hold of you on Twitter and all your kind of social media stuff?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I would like to say is just everybody out there that's listening, you have no idea how much I appreciate your support. We could not do this without you. Your love for these old games is really what inspires us to do what we do. And I know that the System Shock remake that we're working on is taking a bit longer than everybody was hoping, including myself, but I'm making sure that we're spending the time and the resources on making something that's really going to wow you and be worth the wait. So thank you for your continued patience and, again, your support. And, yeah, keep playing old games. They're the best.
Right on, man. Well, hey, thanks again for coming on, and good luck with the studio, and I'm sure we'll be hearing some cool stuff from you guys very, very soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.